Welcome to Hollywood Sports Power, the show about the story behind the story. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, no stranger to this show, family to me, Anthony Big A Stabile. The Big A is a legend in horse racing, in radio, in calling. You know, his resume is longer than my arm. But, you know, we always enjoy talking to him and wanted to have him on today so we could talk about the Road to the Derby, our latest list of restaurants, and everything else that's coming up. So, Big A, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark, what's happening?
Not too much. How are you doing? It's good to hear
doing
from
all
you.
All right. Yeah, you as well. Always enjoy coming on Hollywood Horsepower, getting ready for Kentucky Derby. As you and I know, you well know, I'm a big baseball and horse racing fan, and that's about it for me. So 50 days until the first pitch of the Major League Baseball season, which is, you know, one of the first marker for me in spring. My birthday is usually right around opening day, too. So I think opening day is the 27th this year. My birthday is March 31st. And then Kentucky Derby on May 3rd. So 50 days till opening day. I guess I was in the Math Science Institute in high school, but I'm not that good in math. But I believe my spidey senses tell me we're less than 90 days away from the Kentucky Derby, too. So pretty remarkable, right around the corner. And getting ready for another fantastic and exciting three-year-old season.
So tell me, what are your thoughts right now? We're into the Road to the Derby. And for those people just joining us, we're with Big A, Anthony Stabile. And, you know, for people that don't know horse racing, explain a little bit about what it takes to get there. Because you have to remember, I know you're used to doing a lot of shows that people are very well-versed. Our show is a little different, the fact that we have people from everybody from the novice to the, you know, people that follow closely. But I think a lot of people don't understand what leads up to the Derby. Like, I don't think people realize that this, not only did this start for the owners and the trainers, you know, a year and a half ago or longer, but, you know, the actual series really has been going now for several months.
Yeah. So it's not quite a playoff system, but there are races where there are Kentucky Derby points available. Churchill Downs, which of course runs the Kentucky Derby, has put this point system in place since 2013. The old system was a horrible one. And this system's a little bit better. Nothing's perfect, and this system could use a tweak or two, but it's on the whole, a much better system than the old earnings system. And you basically play your way in, race your way in this instance, to the Kentucky Derby. And there are points races. And as we get closer to the first Saturday in May, the races become more valuable points-wise, to the point where the last series of races, they're called prep races in racing, the winner and pretty much the second-place finisher are almost automatically assured a berth. The winners of the last two rounds of prep races and the second place finisher in the last round of prep races are almost assured a spot in the Derby starting gate. Limited to 20 starters. So, you know, those are some precious spots. And with the money spent on breeding rights and, you know, and just horses in general at this point, getting to the Kentucky Derby is extremely important for not only now a trainer and a jockey's career and the horse's career, obviously, but for the breeders as well. When there are much richer races in the world money wise, but you know, when you're a trainer, especially, or a jockey, and you run into somebody who doesn't really follow horse racing that much and they find out, they're not asking you if you won the Dubai World Cup or the Saudi Cup, which are 12 million and 20 million respectively. They're asking if you won the Kentucky Derby. Won the Kentucky Derby. And that's here. That's in Brisbane, Australia. That's in Gravesend, Brooklyn. That's in Nova Scotia. They're asking you.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? So it's kind of like that even in NASCAR. It's like nobody really cares other than Daytona 500.
Right. You win the Daytona 500.
You win every other race of the year, but they know the 500.
No. Yeah. It's phenomenal.
And Derby, I kind of equate to the 500. It's a very similar feel from somebody outside looking in.
Yeah, it's Americana. It's part of the, it's part of the fabric.
You know, one thing I've always been curious about, and I've been, it has come up more and more over the last few years, how much, and you touched on it, you know, there's a lot of other higher purse races, maybe not anything more high prestige than the Derby, and I would agree that that is something that every trainer and owner seeks. You know, they want that in their trophy case and on their resume. And it does make a difference in the breeding shed for value and for demand. But do you think strategically people are starting to position, you know, towards other races as well? Like, are they bypassing the Derby and pointing their horse towards other races?
No. No, that'll never happen
with the Derby.
They're trying to get to the Derby with your three-year-old. Yeah, that anybody, and anybody who tells you anything different is a bold-faced liar. And if they have a three-year-old worth anything, they're trying to get there. Now, something that's happened more so over the course of the last 20 years is there has been a little bit of a allowance, if you will, of these trainers to let certain horses develop a little bit more. And by that, I mean, you know, breeding season, horses are born between January and May. Most of them fall into the February, March, April wheelhouse. But some of the later foals, especially, you know, some of the horses that are born in late April or early May, and sometimes even into June, I believe, Mucho Macho Man, who went on to be a multiple graded stakes winner, grade one winner, he didn't turn three officially until like the week of the Belmont Stakes because he was a June foal.
Wow.
I think you're seeing things now where, and you know, it doesn't necessarily have to do with a birth date or anything like that. Just horses that aren't developing as quickly as some of their peers, they're allowed to just not be rushed and to come along a little later in the year because there are so many more lucrative races. I try to explain that to people. People are like, well, you know, sometimes you'll see a Kentucky Derby. The Derby will have 20 almost every year. 20 are entered. Even more are entered. And there's horses that are also eligible.
Yeah,
that won't get sick or anything. He'll come out before 9 o'clock the day before the race. You know, it used to be where if you had, and you hardly ever had 20 in the Derby. You know, if you had 15 in the Derby, 9 of them would come back and run in the Preakness. And then maybe 7 of those would come back and run in the Belmont. Well, now, over the course of that 5-week span, you'll have 20 horses in the Derby. If you're lucky, you'll get 3 of them in the Preakness. And some of the Derby horses will wait until the Belmont Stakes. Or some of them will wait until the races like the Travers. And part of that is because of how big the purses are. Races like the Haskell
and
Monmouth.
At that point, if they don't feel that they've got a horse in contention, you know, if they didn't win the Derby, they're not going to be in contention for the Triple Crown. So now it becomes more strategic. They're starting to look at purses and what best suits that horse's campaign.
Yeah, and there are lucrative ways to get, you know, the Ohio Derby's worth $500,000, a West Virginia Derby, and these are all races that will serve as prep races for a race like the Haskell, a race like the Travers, which are, you know, the Travers at Saratoga is coined the Midsummer Derby. So,
sure.
You know, races with prestige and now, you know, gigantic price tags on them as well. So the game has changed in that aspect, but the truth of the matter is if you can get to the Derby, these guys and gals do what they can.
And you touched on something that is interesting. And for people joining us, you know, when you start talking about birthdays on horses, you know, Big A touched on it, and like, it is a little bit, I don't want to call it a disadvantage, but it's definitely a challenge for a horse that's born mid-year, because for thoroughbred, they all turn a year older on January 1st. So if you have a horse that's born in June versus a horse that's born, say, February 1st, you know, you're at a little bit of a disadvantage. You know, I mean, that horse is going to be a little bit behind in some cases.
Well, yeah, not necessarily. But yes, I mean,
well, I mean, a few months, you know, it could make a difference.
it's something with the horses. It's like anything else, right? And obviously, horses don't live, unfortunately. I wish they lived longer than us, to be honest with you. But horses don't live as long as humans, so the rate is different. But if I wanted to, and Oaklawn Park does this, and it's surprising. So horses, like Mark said, are classified a year older on January 1st just for the bookkeeping and to make things simple and to classify the races. So at Oaklawn Park, they'll start running the 3-year olds against the older horses already. That happens on February 1st every year. The horses that have never won races are called maidens. They'll start racing. It's the equivalent, because now you could have a 3-year old running against a 6-year old. And more often than not, on February 1st, that 3-year old's not necessarily 3 years old yet. So you could have a 3-year old running against a 6-year old. It would be the equivalent in maturity, and so I'm not saying ability, but would be the equivalent of a horse, in a human, in maturity and size and knowledge, for the lack of a better term, of playing a 7-year old against a 12 or a 13 year old. You wouldn't even think about doing that. You wouldn't put a 7-year old who's playing, who just got out of T-ball, and pitched and let a 13 year old start throwing him a curveball if you were playing baseball. So, you know, it's different. It's not as bad when it's a few months, you know, when you get to a year or two, certainly as the horses are younger, it becomes a little different.
Well, that's what I was getting at. Yeah. Like, to me, I would agree. When they get to be 3 or 4, even 5, that few months isn't critical. Where I notice it, and I see it all the time, because, you know, I'm coming to you from Gulfstream today. You know, when you look at the 2-year-olds compared to what they call 3-year-olds, the 2-year-olds just look like babies. I mean, they look so much younger. But I mean, what you're talking about, in some cases, it could be a difference of 6 months between these two groups.
Yeah.
But it looks a whole lot more than 6 months. I mean, that 2 to 3 year old, you know, horse, they really advance a lot, it seems like. It's like they, and then 3 to 4, even more. You know, you look at the difference between a 2.5 year old horse and a 4-year-old horse, and they don't even look the same. I mean, they look so much more mature. Manes come in and they seem more subtle. You know, you look at the babies, of course, you know, Gulfstream, you see a lot of babies. This is where they run along the 2-year-olds for the first time. And yeah, they just look like puppies out of the track. Kind of
puppies. Well, they are. For the most part, they are. And, you know, the horses take big steps forward physically and, you know, maturity-wise between 2 and 3, and then again from 3 to 4. And then after, like, midway through the 4-year-old year, they kind of level off and kind of is what it is.
Well, it seems it's funny. I actually got with a guy from Australia yesterday, and we were talking. And as you know, like, in Australia and in the UK, they race a much longer. And he was commenting about how strange it seems to him that they don't see 6, 7, 8, 9 year old horses racing very often.
Well,
you know, because
it's different down there. It's different down
there.
Yeah, they don't
completely.
They don't have the $1 million races every other month, every month.
No,
you know, they've stayed more tried and true to the sport of it, whereas now it's a lot more of a business. So,
yeah, very true. So tell us who you're kind of following the Derby. I know you don't want to give away your tips, but who are the early attention getters that have got your attention, and what is kind of the next steps in the road to the Derby? You know, as we go into February, March, like what's kind of the path?
Well, the big headline this year will be the return of Bob Baffert.
Sure.
Has been barred from the last several derbies, and he'll be allowed here now. He has the 2-year-old champion who returned a winner in the Bob Lewis named Citizen Bull. I don't know if he's going to get that mile and a quarter distance, the 10 furlongs of the Kentucky Derby. But right now, he's got to be considered one of the favorites. I'll be honest with you, I don't really have a Derby horse right now. I know that's weird for you to hear out of my lips because I, you know, the 7-8 years we've known each other, I've had somebody by now. I don't really have one. You know, we talked about how it's changed a little bit. A lot of these trainers now, they used to run them 3, 4 times, 5 times before the Derby as a 3-year-old before the actual Derby. And now they run them a couple of times. They don't bring some of the better ones back until March. And so right now we're about to start that second-ish round of prep races. And the main routes go through New York, where we just ran the Withers last week. That had some points on the line, not enough to get into the Derby, but that had some points on the line. The aforementioned Bob Lewis at Santa Anita had some points on the line, but again, not enough. That was the 2-year-old champion. The next step here in New York is the Gotham. In the beginning of March, the winner of that race gets 50 points, an automatic berth, essentially. We'll have the Rebel coming up soon at, well, we'll have the Southwest and the Rebel coming up at Oakland Park in Arkansas. Got the Tim F. Davis coming up this week at Tampa Bay Downs. But again, these are still, it's weird. You know, the best way to equate it is you start the NBA playoffs and you have 8 teams in each conference. Well, the first round is already done. The second round, now we've got 8 down to 4. You know, those rounds are coming now. 4 is going to come down to 2 in early April. And then you get to the Derby, and that's obviously your championship. With one extra round, I guess the NCAA tournament would almost be a better example. But yeah.
What's the name of Box Wars?
Citizen Bowl. Well, that's the 2-year-old champ. Bob has about 15 3-year-olds nominated. I don't have the exact number. This was the week, though.
No, I did notice that, and I have to tell you, I would be shocked if you did not see him in the circle. I just have this feeling like he is going to send a message. I mean, he's won 7 times. He definitely knows the combination. And if he could put a horse together, I mean, I realize there's a lot that can happen between now and then, but I just feel like he's going to come in hard.
I would imagine he'd like to have a brigade down there for his first time allowed back in several years. Yeah, I would imagine he's going to want to have as many as he possibly can. I would probably set the over under 2.5 right now and take the over. I would say he runs 3 horses in the Derby this year. By hook or by crook.
How many trainers can
run
the Derby? I know it's probably something that doesn't come up very often, but it is interesting when you see that.
Well, there are guys, you know, and I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but guys like Todd Fletcher and Brad Cox, and they're 2 of the biggest trainers in the country, Chad Brown, you know, in some cases have multiple dozens of horses.
Sure.
Oh, nominated. Yeah. So
Baffert generally has over 100. Probably closer to 150 at any given.
Well, he'll have 102-year-olds, but he'll only have like 25 or 30 nominated because some horses, you know about their distance limits.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about just specifically Derby. I'm saying everybody. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. But you know, with the Triple Crown out of there, and then it gets so the 373 nominations this week, and that gets you eligible to all 3 races. Well, let's say you know, and for $600, by the way, but there are plenty of times you see it almost every year where there'll be a horse that falls through those figurative cracks and they have to pay $100,000 to be supplemented to the Preakness or $125,000 to be supplemented to the Belmont Stakes, which sounds ridiculous. There's another payment sometime in like mid-March or late March where you can get in for $3,000 if you miss the $600. But that number won't get over $400 this year. So, you know, you've now taken a crop of 17 or 18,000 horses and limited it to 400, 375 or so, and you know one of them is going to win the Kentucky Derby in all likelihood. And then you go from there. But right now, I'm still, I have not been overwhelmed by Citizen Bowl. I would imagine that a lot's going to happen in the next 85, 90 days. I would be very surprised if he won the Kentucky Derby just because I don't think he's going to want to stretch out in distance, but, you know, I've taken many, many shots against Bob Baffert in the Kentucky Derby. I don't think I've ever picked a Bob Baffert horse to win the Kentucky Derby.
Really?
Well, I don't pick a lot of, I don't like picking a lot of favorites. And he's often the favorite. I don't know if I've ever picked a Bob Baffert horse to win the Kentucky Derby, now that I'm thinking about it.
American Pharaoh.
I did not pick American Pharaoh. American Pharaoh, though, taught me a very valuable lesson. I picked the horse by the name of Mubtaij, who won the United Arab Emirates Derby over in Dubai. And, he was one of the most impressive winners over there. Forever Young, who ran a bang-up second in the Derby here last year, won that race last year. And he came closest to winning the Derby. But until one of them win it, I won't pick another one of them. As far as Baffert goes, I would imagine he'll have a strong contingent. And I would imagine I won't be picking any of them. I never have.
Well, you know, it's funny you touched on Pharaoh. You know, one of the things that stood out to me, and I remember this really clearly, I had an old guy in Lexington tell me early on, and I had never even heard his name at that point. He said, keep an eye on American Pharaoh. And I said, really? And he said, if you look at the number of horses that have won the Arkansas Derby that go on to be in the top three at the Kentucky Derby, it's pretty high. And that was what made him stand out at first to a lot of people in Kentucky, I know. And it's kind of interesting to me how the numbers stack up, and you can probably talk to this way better than I could. But there's certain races that it seems like if they win that race, the numbers just jump for them to be pretty tough in the Derby. You know, Florida Derby comes to mind, Arkansas Derby comes to mind, and I'm sure there's many others even before.
The final prep race, positivity, if you will, has changed throughout the years. But, back in 2004, Smarty Jones sort of made that Arkansas route a very popular one, and the Sella family at Oaklawn has poured a lot of money into making it easily the most lucrative path. I believe three of the prep races are worth $1 million now, which is pretty ridiculous when you're considering that a horse that is going to earn 20 points can earn $600,000 just for winning a 20-point prep race. It's the most lucrative path that I could tell you.
Is it just the first money for the track?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that's a big part of it, Bob. Yeah. And I think that when you get comfortable, he's comfortable now shipping from California, running in these races. It's also a bit of a more traditional path. They start with the Smarty Jones at a mile. And that's around two turns. And then the Southwest and the Rebel go a mile and a 16th. And then the Arkansas Derby goes a mile and an eighth. In New York, it's weird. So the longer the distance, more often than not, the more turns you run. So in New York, the Withers is the first 20-point, the 20-point race of the Withers is around a mile and an eighth at two turns. The Gotham worth 50 points cuts back to a mile around one turn. And then the Wood Memorial stretches back out to a mile and an eighth like the Withers for 100 points. A lot of guys and gals don't want to run their horse 9 furlongs to cut them back for 8 to run back at 9 again. So they'll often skip the Withers. Or if they run in the Withers, they'll skip the Gotham. Very rare you'll see them running both just because they don't want to confuse their horse at this point. They want to just keep them around the two turns and keep them going longer. You know, and then the Fairgrounds completely goes off the beaten path where the LeCompte starts at a mile and a 16th. The Risen Star goes to a mile and an eighth. And then the Louisiana Derby, which is one of it's the longest time out for a 100-point race. It's 6 or 7 weeks out, depending on how the year falls. But it's the longest prep race at a mile and 3/16ths along with the UAE Derby. So when you consider that the Preakness is run at that same distance, your horse, you would imagine, has a higher fitness level having already raced just a 16th of a mile rather than an 1/8 of a mile shorter than the Derby, but you're also giving that the proximity to the race up a little bit. It's 6 weeks out as opposed to four or five like races, you know, like the time between the Arkansas Derby and the Wood Memorial in New York and the Santa Anita Derby out in California. So, you know, the different paths have their plaudits and their pratfalls, and you just find something that's comfortable, and Bob's obviously found a comfortable path, especially a lucrative one through Arkansas.
Do you notice that with a lot of trainers? Like, do you kind of see the same path? Like, does Fletcher tend to follow a certain path and Brown follow a certain path? Or does it really depend a lot on the horse? Are they looking more at, like, this horse seems like he'd be a good fit?
Well, you got to remember, Mark, that these guys have multiple horses. So Brad Cox, I had a real good conversation with Brad Cox about this back in, I guess it would be 2021. Brad had a host of horses pointing to different races. And Mandaloon, who wound up getting put up via disqualification when Bob Baffert's Medina Spirit was disqualified from the win for the medication positive. I had talked to Brad about how he was separating his three-year-old. And it was the best conversation I've ever had with any trainer about this. You know, some of these guys and gals will get stereotyped into, well, it's verse, chorus, verse for these three-year-olds every year. And it's the term we use is, it's like a factory. And it's correct. And it's not a respectful way to classify it or identify it, but it's kind of true with some of these trainers. Brad, when I talked to him, he was very succinct and had a game plan for his horses. And he told me that, you know, when they first come in, you obviously don't know, but by October or November, not only does he see if they have the quality and the metal, but he starts to figure out where he's going to go. And, you know, his two big paths are Oaklawn and the fairgrounds in Louisiana. And Mandaloon kind of identified himself as a horse that was going to benefit from the longer stretch at the fairgrounds and from the extra distance in the fairground preparations. So he was going to the fairgrounds. And he kind of knew that. And I think he told me he knew that before the Breeders' Cup. Like, he knew that in October. And I was real impressed by that because he'd given it so much thought. I can't remember. I made a big bet on Mandaloon at 25-1 too, because I liked him a lot. I can't remember some of the other horses Brad ran that year, but I remember him giving me, we did like a 20-minute radio interview, and I was so impressed at just the thought process that he went through. And some of the other big time trainers, when I thought about things that year, and I was still writing for a website out in Vegas back then, they don't really do much racing coverage anymore. I remember when I was writing this, and I was like, you know, he's the only guy that's ever really given me good stuff like this. Like, it was just good content. I didn't even need to, like, put my mat. I mean, I'm a little bit of a cocky when it comes to writing. I think it's probably, and some of my biggest fans, Mom, Nicole, they would probably tell you that I write the best. That's the thing I do best. I didn't even have to write. It was literally just transcribing his words. I gave him credit for it, obviously, but it was like, he was so thoughtful. He had given it so much thought. I was mad for him when Mandaloon got beat. I was even madder when Medina Spirit got disqualified because he was right in his process and I didn't get paid at 25-1. But that interview that day really left an impression on me. So just know going in, when you're betting on Brad Cox horses in these prep races, there is a considerable amount of thought going into why they're separated and why they're in the places they are.
And I would agree. I think Brad is a great guy. And I also think he's probably one of the most outside the sport now. I'm not saying that sport, and I mean this with absolute respect. It'll sound horrible. It's not meant to be. I feel like he's one of the most underrated trainers. And what I mean by that is I feel like a lot of people don't know about him, even though he's been around forever. And I feel like he's definitely an A-list trainer. But he seems to be one of those guys that's kind of like quiet. Like, you don't you don't see him a lot. Is, you know, if you're in the industry, obviously, you know, Brad Johnson. You couldn't find two people in North America knowing outside the industry. And
yeah,
that's,
you know
what I mean. So, I mean, you talk about like Fletcher, Brown, Baffert. People know that.
Well, he doesn't have the big head of, the big moppy head of gray hair like Baffert does with the sunglasses. Or, he doesn't have the flowing locks of a Steve Asmussen. He doesn't have the soccer player hairdo and the looks and the Mike Rapolis running around him like Todd Fletcher does, right? Chad Brown gets his attention for other reasons. Brad just kind of walks through the racetrack. He's very unassuming. You know, he's always in his, you know, the way to point out, the way to know you're talking to Brad Cox, his colors are blue and he identifies with his stable. he identifies with his stable. And I think that's a very important aspect of a trainer, because when you identify with your stable and he is, him and Todd probably do it the most. They all do it. But him and Todd probably are the quickest to pass the accolades along to the whole team. They all do. Chad does it. Steve does it a lot too. I mean,
yeah,
Steve's team is family.
George. Yeah.
Bob will do it. You know, Steve does it. It's his family for crying out loud.
Yeah.
But, you know, Brad's very quick. And listen, when you have, he has a stable in New York. My buddy Dustin Dugas runs the stable in New York. Dustin doesn't have that many horses, but he does a great job. He has an operation at Gulfstream. He has an operation at Fairgrounds. He has an operation at Oaklawn. So the only place he doesn't really have an operation is California, where the big racing is going on. He has an operation at Turfway Park, which is the winter home of Kentucky racing. He's got five operations of multiple dozen horses, multiple dozens of horses right now. That's a lot to do. That's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of work.
It's funny because you're the other guy that he almost reminds me of. And I don't know why. I can't put my finger on it. But he kind of reminds you of like a young Dale Roberts. Dale was kind of the same way. Kind of like unassuming, sort of quiet. You didn't, you know, everybody didn't know him. But if you were inside the industry, you definitely.
Yeah. And I kind of. They all went and lost all the weight. He's a GQ model now. So, yeah, but no, I mean, listen.
It's just super, you know, nice guys. I mean, I like them both. I think they're super. It's just interesting to me that what I consider very successful guys don't seem to be the household names of some other
people. Yeah. I mean, like you said, you know, outside of horse racing, a lot of people don't know who Brad Cox is. I want to know why. I think he's very happy about that. I don't think that is upset in the least by that.
No, there's something to that, right? I mean, you know, I know on this show, you know, I come across a lot of celebrities, and you know, I was actually talking to a guy the other day, very well known. He made a comment. He was looking at a show, and there was like this huge crowd at the concert, and he said, I wish I could stand right in the middle and nobody knew who I was.
Yeah.
And it kind of hit me when he said that. I thought, damn it, I never thought about that. But you kind of
I never met a camera I didn't like. So I like the attention. But I know a lot of people don't. And I can understand, you know, you understand why too, because you see what some of these big names and these celebrities go through. I'm not that big enough of a name to go through it. I enjoy the, I'm a ham, as you well know.
But you also, you have to admit, you kind of have the best of both worlds because you can't escape it. So if you get away from horse racing far, you probably don't get recognized as often. I'm not going to say you ever do, but it isn't like if you go to a track, you probably get stopped every 10 feet.
Every time. But I'll tell you a funny story. I was with an ex-girlfriend. And this was a while ago. And we went to a diner by Belmont to have breakfast. And a few people, town over, Franklin Square. So we're in this diner in Franklin Square. It's about 4 miles from Belmont. And an actual, a friend of mine came in, but a couple of other people who go to the track and stuff came over and grabbed a selfie and everything. And we were headed out east on Long Island for, I think it was, I don't remember. He's gone, thank God. Not from the planet, but from my life. We went out east, probably went 80, 75, 80 miles out east on Long Island. And we went to this little hole in the wall diner. And she said something on the way out, like something like, I hope you're going to be okay without any attention for a few days. I was like, yeah, I'll be fine. And sure enough, we like check in on Sunday night. Monday morning, we go to breakfast at this hole in the wall diner out east on Long Island. And I had my back to the door, which ordinarily is not the case, but you know, I was just relaxing and probably hungover. And I was very excited. I remember they had black beans for my omelet. I'm eating my eggs, and she's like, oh my God. I was like, what? She's like, I think this guy recognized you at the front of the restaurant. I was like, come on, man. So I finish up my breakfast. She finishes up her breakfast, and we ask for a check, and sure enough, the check's taken care of. So the waitress points the gentleman out. He comes walking over. He goes, you're Anthony Stabile, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, I'm such a big fan. And his wife starts chiming in, oh my God, when you're on the TV doing Talking Horses with Andy, everybody in the house has to shut up and everything. So yeah, but I mean, I can go to Citi Field and go to a Mets game and more often than not be good.
Now, see, that surprises me actually, because I would think in New York, in a Mets game, because there is such a crossover between horse racing and baseball, I would think you'd run into a lot of people.
Wrestling events. When I go to wrestle, when I go to WWE events, and I'm a huge WWE fan, I will get recognized almost every time. And it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool because,
but
you know, more of an
honor. Not at the best game.
I think we're all too focused on, what's going on in front of us. We are as rabid as it gets. So, it's been a very good off season. Mom and I already have tickets. Phyllis is taking me to David Wright's retirement, number retirement and induction into the Mets Hall of Fame on July 19th. I'm very excited. There was a Christmas present. I'm very excited about that. I'm going to try and talk her into bundling up for opening day. Even though she doesn't deal with the cold very well. I mean, I've lost 30 pounds, but I still have my natural insulation. So getting
when's
to, March 27th, right before my birthday. It's always right around my birthday.
You never know. It might be nice.
We've had snow on the ground. We've had snow on, when I was at the New York Post 20 years ago, I had tickets opening day and it was too cold for me. My girlfriend at the time was you know, I can't do this today. Right. I was like,
is it normally still pretty cold opening day?
Yeah, it's cold into April. Mom and I don't go usually until May, unless it's a very, very rare day game appearance. I remember we went one year, I think it was 2019 for Game of Thrones night, and they were giving out a Noah Syndergaard, Game of Thrones inspired bobblehead. And she's bundled up. She's all you see are her eyes. It was cold. For me to say that, you know me. You see me in shorts all year long when you come to New York and visit. I was cold.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I would be worse than your mom because, you know, I look like that if it's 50 degrees.
Correct. Yeah. You would not survive. You would not survive Citi Field in the wind, the howling winds of Jamaica Bay on March 27th. Buddy, I can tell you that.
Set it up around my chair.
Yeah. No, you would not be in good shape. You would not be in good shape. So.
Want to go to a Mets game, though. That's something on my list for this year.
All right, we'll get to this.
Never
year.
Bet. And we'll I would want to, you and I need to go.
We always talk restaurants, but so one of it was my favorite building on earth. It's really sad. Two of my, probably, you know, my house doesn't count. I've lived in the same house my whole life. My two of my three favorite buildings on earth are gone. Shea Stadium and Belmont Park. So Shea Stadium was always one, Aqueduct's two, Belmont's three. Shea and Belmont are gone, and there'll be no racing at Aqueduct in two or three years, but the casino will be there. So at least the building, and I live a mile and a quarter from Aqueduct. At least the building will be there. The other two places are gone. The only remnants of Shea in the parking lot at Citi Field, there are home plate and base markers where the plate and first, second, and third base, and I think maybe a pitcher's mound were. That's it. That's it.
So I have to ask, did you get any remnants from Belmont? Did you get any souvenirs when they tore it down?
I got nothing. It happened so quickly. And you want to know what's funny about that? You're not the first person that's asked. You're the first person that's asked publicly. There was nothing there at Belmont that I really, really wanted. I can't explain that because I've always loved Belmont Park, but there was nothing there specifically that I really wanted. Now, when the racing ceases at Aqueduct, I don't even care. I will be in that place like a pirate going after a few things. While I was still working.
I was like that with Hollywood Park. Hollywood Park was my favorite racetrack. And when it closed, I was heartbroken because I felt like we lost a piece of history. And the only thing I got out of it really wasn't even of my own doing, from friends, Michael Blomgren, one of them, was some Saddle Club. And that's, not that that's nothing. I mean, I think it's really cool. I have an Outriders one. I have a Race Warm one. I actually have a Treehouse, from Hollywood Park. But it's kind of funny. I wish I, there were suits that they were getting rid of, and I wish I'd gotten them. But yeah, I understand. I kind of understand. Like, there's certain things that are just iconic, but then there's other places you go, like, there's nothing here that really, there's not a piece that I could take with me that's always going to remind me. But
on December 13th, 2018, I walked into the announcer's booth at Aqueduct Racetrack. I was 40, how do we screw this up? I was 41, turning 42. That's about right. All right, 2018, yeah. I'll be 48 this year. I was 41, turning 42. And from the time I was 8 years old, it was the only place I ever wanted to be. And I called that race standing up. But when, thanks to Frank Miramati, when John and Brielle, my two mentors in the booth, when John started training me, and that's really what he did. He, and John's retired now, so I can give his, not his secrets away. John called the races sitting down. And for my weight and my breathing, we both decided that it would be better to call the races sitting down. So there's this ledge around the booth at Aqueduct that is desk chair high. So it's just like sitting at a desk. And it's maybe 2.5 feet of wood that juts out from the wall. And it goes from about halfway through the office. You walk into the office, it starts about halfway. And it starts and it goes around the triangular pointed window and down the other side of the wall. I'll let them know because I've called John. And, Frank's a California guy. Frank's the track announcer at Santa Anita and Saratoga. Frank has spent some time at Aqueduct, but it doesn't have the sentimentality it does to me. I've spoken to John, and I've spoken to Tom Durkin, because in my life, that's their booth. It will never be anybody else. That was never anybody else's booth. So it's Tom Durkin and John Embriel. Neither of them want the wood. I'm walking in there with a crowbar and taking the wood. Because I can tell you that that is where my dream came true. And I can tell you that there is a picture of Tonalist winning the 2015 Cigar Mile. It is the race that kept me in horse racing. It also looks over the spot I met my person. on March 9th, 2019.
Oh, that's cool.
And I don't know how I'm going to procure that picture. It's gigantic. Like, it's enough for, like, the wallpaper of an entire man cave wall. It's huge. His birthday's Tuesday. Talking about the birthdays, right? These are the ones you know. Your sure. favorite horse of all time. You know, Easy Goers, March 20th. You know, Funny Side, April 21st. Like, these are the things that you have to know. I don't know how I'm getting it, and I don't know where I'm putting it, but I'm going to do everything I can to get that picture because he kept me in that racing. He watched me the day I first looked into Nicole's eyes, and I would not be doing any. I never would have met you. I never would have called a race. I never would have done my TV stuff. I never would have started to work on my next little project that I can't talk about right now, but it's going to be absolutely huge, and we will talk about it soon. None of it would happen if he didn't win that race on November 28th, 2015. So my attachments are to the Big A. I mean, how my nickname is based on the place, essentially.
So it's kind of funny because I think most people think of you like the King of Belmont. And
well, the Beast really of the Belmont because I've had so much success in the race. Yeah. But I mean,
yeah.
Aqueduct is, and I mean, literally, you know, so we're recording this on the 6th. The 9th, Sunday is my anniversary of calling my first full card. It'll be 5 years. I remember going to get a bagel in the morning before I went over, and I was going to eat in my office my office was right down the hall from the announcer's booth. And I was going to go to the office and eat the bagel. And I remember I went to the bagel place, which is about a mile and a quarter from me. And I came back home and the same girl, that was just about the end of that relationship, thankfully. And that's when I started the relationship with Nicole. I looked at the ex and she was like, "What are you doing here?" I drove back home. I looked at her. I was like, "Let me explain something to you." I have probably went either in my car, my father's car, my uncle's car, my grandfather's car, may he rest in peace, a taxi from Right On before there was all of these car services online. So I probably made this trip 5,000 times. And if you think the first day I don't call a full card and the only place I've ever wanted to be, so now it's the only place I've ever wanted to be professionally, and the person I'm supposed to spend the rest of my life with, I meet her in that same building. So yeah, I have, it's given me everything great in my life. If you think I'm not starting my day by leaving from this house to drive that path that I've done 5,000 times, you're out of your mind. So my attachment is to Aqueduct, and when the racing stops there in a few years, it will be a very, very sad day. It'll be nice to know that the building's still there. I can go play some poker and still make some money in there, but it'll be a very sad day in Estrada.
And that's a definite, right? They're very excited they want to be
there. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to put that. They took $500 million from the state to build Belmont Park. It's, you know, it was funny because it was a gentleman who lives in Scotland. Him and I with a couple other people, Andy Serling and Kit Paul Vitarosa, who's doing some talking horses and some TV for Nye right now. Since I left, we had a little Twitter conversation today, and the Big Apple, the term the Big Apple for New York City comes from horse racing.
Sure.
A lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you took a bite out of the Big Apple. There were 7 racetracks originally. 3 in Brooklyn, Gravesend, Brighton Beach, and Sheepshead Bay. 2 in the Bronx, Jerome Park and Morris Park. The first racetrack in the country was in Garden City, Long Island. So a lot of people think that these tracks are named for, that these races are named for the towns in and on Long Island and in New York City. They're not. They're named for the old racetracks, the Gravesend, the Sheepshead Bay, the Jerome, the Garden City, the Jamaica. These were all racetracks in the New York City area. Even Monmouth Park. Monmouth Park in New York, in Oceanport, New Jersey, was originally considered part of New York Racing. And at some point, it consolidated down from 7 to 5, after Prohibition, after gambling was outlawed in 1913, all of the Brooklyn tracks closed. And, when it came back, it took a bite out of the Big Apple, and there were 5 tracks left. And Aqueduct opened, and Belmont opened. So we took a bite out of the Big Apple. That's how they, that's how the term came to, was coined.
That's amazing. I love stories like that. Hey, we're coming up on the top of the hour. So real quick, I've got to ask you, restaurant. I'm obviously familiar with King Alberto's, favorite of both of ours. What else has been doing exciting since you went to it?
So since we've been spending so much time at Aqueduct, people have been asking for the popular places. The most popular place around Aqueduct is Don Pepp's. The problem with Don Pepp's is it's closed during the month of February. So you're left scrambling.
The entire month.
They close for the entire month. They close February and August. And part of the reason they used to close for August is because the whole crew would go up to Saratoga when it was only 4 weeks and they'd open a restaurant up there for the beef. That's how popular the food is with the racing set here in New York. Yeah. It's the Aqueduct equivalent to Belmont's King Umberto's. We always go to King Umberto's. We
do
always go to Steve's Pickle of Boost.
Do they go up to Saratoga and open a restaurant?
No, no more. But they still take the month off. No more going to Saratoga though. The Italian place around me that I go to, it's a knockaround place. It's got pizza and heroes and rolls and all kinds of delicious pastas as well. It's called Divino's. It's a Howard Beach place. Been around for about 5 or 6 years. It was the old Lenny's Pizza. Divino's is the place. Divino's and La Villa. Those are the two places. If you're coming to Aqueduct and you need Italian food and you don't want to drive over to King Umberto's, or it's February and you can't go to Don Pepp's. I mean, I'm always going to King Umberto, but you're talking to a guy that just spent, you're talking to a guy that just spent 27 weeks going back and forth to Rochester every week. So I don't, not too normal. But certainly a 12-mile ride for me is not going to stop me from going to get my cappellini cakes and my shrimp bonacina from Chitto and the gang at King Umberto's. I'm actually having a little high school reunion there in a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's really cool.
But yeah, around here, if you're at Aqueduct, you don't want to, and you're staying in the city, you don't want to trek around, you go there, you go to Divino's or La Villa in Howard Beach.
Well, and I would tell people, if you're in Aqueduct, if you're there for more than one night, you need to take a trip over to King Alberto.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's not that far. You should go if you're here for one night.
Yeah, but I get what you're saying. If you can only do something close to the track, you know, we understand. But if you've got any extra time at all, go into yourself, go check King Alberto. It brings us up to the top of the hour, and I know it feels like it's just vaporized on us, but we do have to respect the network a little bit. But I've got to plug a couple of people that we really appreciate very much. You know, the first and foremost is MB Gray. If your company has benefits, if you have employees, you have employee benefit headaches, I promise you, there's only one person in the insurance industry that you should be talking to. MB Gray, mbgrayhealthcare.com. She's a legend in the business. She is the absolute best of the best, and she will not cost you a dime. She saves you money. So if she talks to you, looks at your company, and says that she can help you, trust me when I tell you she's the person you should be working with. The other place is ROC Tournaments. Carlos and the gang, they do a lot of good things. It's ROCTournaments.com. Check them out. They've got tournaments all over South Florida. They're part of the World Cup. And we always support NoFallenHeroes.org. Wiz Buckley, Top Gun fighter pilot, great guy, his wife Susie. They are doing everything they can to help with veteran suicide. And truthfully, in my opinion, he's doing more than anybody else. The other thing is Old Friends Equine Dental. Yeah, I was trying to help Mike with that. Old Friends is an amazing place. If you're near Georgetown, Kentucky, you'll see yourself and check it out. So, Big A, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. We enjoy you every time. We have to do this again to talk restaurants because we ran out of time this time talking Derby. But
talk to you again soon, Mark.
Yeah, if you're in New York, go to King Alberto's. It's
We're in Miami. Go to the Palm. And we will see you again next week. This has been Hollywood Horsepower. Talk to you again soon.